From two beautifully scenic and historic locations, the Hudson Valley, New York, and Willow, Alaska, this is The Side Vibe, brought to you by Dog Works Radio. Your hosts are author, journalist, and photographer, the Five Sides mom, Dorothy Wills Raftery, and Dog Works Radio executive producer, canine behaviorist, trainer, and lead musher of Team Aneke, Robert Forto. The Side Vibe is all about the magnificent breed of the Siberian Husky. From training to grooming, and for those who show and breed, from parenting to playing and rescuing huskies in need, whether mushing over snow-covered trails or lounging on tropical shores, even for Hollywood sides on the big silver screen and so very much more. If it's about a Siberian Husky, we'll chat about it here.
Hello and welcome, everybody. You are listening to the Side Vibe today. Calling in from the Hudson Valley of New York is our host, Dorothy Wills Raftery. Dorothy, how's it going?
Hi, Robert. It's going well. We are having a bright, sunny spring day here today, so it's all skies are blue. How about up by you?
You know, we're in the middle of spring. Our bees come next week, next weekend. The flowers are popping out, and the snow has melted.
That's right. You're in your second year of being a beekeeper, right?
Third, actually.
Third? That's great.
Yes. Yes. So what's happening in the Five Side world? I know that you're always busy rocking and rolling. What's happening over your way?
The main project right now I'm excited about, which, has been, it's put on hold, for a lot of different reasons. But I've been wanting to do my fivesides.com website, and looks like we're getting closer and closer. I'll be meeting again with my web designer on Monday, and I'm hoping that we'll be able to launch that before summer, and that's going to be a lot of fun. It's actually about 6 years in the making, but as you know, different projects pop up, and I think I've had over on Arctic House Publishing, we've been under construction for like ever, and then the Five Sides blog, has always been near and dear to my heart, but I really wanted to have a site where, with blogging, your stories get down, and they keep going down lower and lower with each new one. So it's not always easy. Sure, you can go to the search box and put in keywords, but I just want to make it a more visitor-friendly site. And, of course, with the Live Give Strong Canine Epilepsy Awareness that I do, I wanted to kind of create a library to kind of have all different resources, my articles and books, as well as links to other resources for folks to go and find information on canine epilepsy a lot easier than trying to search through the blog. And, a lot of times you hit and miss different articles. And I'm just really excited. It's really coming together, and it's looking really good. And I'm hoping that it'll be a really great resource for folks.
I'm looking forward to that as well. And you had mentioned website promotion and updates. I have four or five websites that I try to keep updated as much as possible. And if you don't keep up on it, it snowballs very quickly, doesn't it? Especially if you have several blogs and Facebook pages and all that, things can run over very quick, and pretty soon you're overwhelmed.
Yes, you're overwhelmed, and in the social media world, it becomes old news quick. I did have a blog, for our show, and then you had that wonderful page, so I kind of left off there probably about a year or more ago. We have the Side Vibe on Dog Works Radio, which is a great page. And, of course, on fivesides.com, there'll be a direct link to my Five Sides blog, to this show at the Side Vibe on Dog Works Radio, and to the archive file. So, not only will it have, a show up, I think we're going to be putting probably like the four prominent shows we'll be highlighting, and then a link to the page so folks can easily find all of our other shows that we've been doing, as well as a link to Arctic House, so it'll take them right over there. So, hopefully everything will be housed under one spot, and then they can go to wherever they would like to go instead of having, five or six different links. There'll also, of course, be a link to our Five Sides Facebook page, as well as our Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, all that will be there. So it'll be kind of like a one-stop visit for everybody, for Huskies, and for canine information.
Of course. What else is happening?
Pretty much trying to wrap up some projects. I'm actually working on two articles right now for Hudson Valley Paw Print Magazine, and one of them is hits near and dear to my heart, and it's going to be about a young girl, a five-year-old girl who has epilepsy, and their plan is to get a seizure alert dog. So, of course, you know, that takes two subjects that are, you know, very close to my heart. So, I'm actually going to be meeting with her this week. She's going to meet some of the Sibes, and I really am looking forward to getting her story out there.
Nice. All right, are you ready to introduce our guest today?
I am. I really am. I'm pretty excited about having her on today. We've chatted a lot over the past couple years, and you know her quite well. She's been on a couple times on your shows. Today we're chatting with Joanne Sundell, author of the Watch Eyes trilogy, Arctic Storm, Arctic Shadow, and her newest and final installment of the series, Arctic Will, which was just released this month, and I'm so thrilled to have a copy of all three. And the series spans from Siberia to Alaska and are not only steeped in fictional fantasy, but also pays homage to the magnificent Siberian husky we know today and its historical roots to the gentle Chukchi blood dogs set against real places and events from in history. Joanne, a licensed nurse, has been married for over 41 years to her husband, Cy, a forensic psychiatrist and previous medical director for the Department of Safety, City and County of Denver. Together, they raised three children in the mountains of Colorado and now have four wonderful grandchildren, two living in California, two in Colorado. And Joanne proudly states that their youngest daughter has followed in her father's footsteps and is an Army major and pathologist, and whose epi dog, Zifton, was one of my stars in my book, Epic Dog Tales, Heartfelt Stories About Amazing Dogs Living and Loving Life with Canine Epilepsy. Joanne first fell in love with the Siberian Husky, she says, when she lived in Colorado, and went on to have several as part of her family over the years. She currently splits her time, she says, chasing her children and grandchildren between Colorado and California. Joanne says she believes in, quote, the human husky bond doesn't happen in a vacuum. Both man and beast must put in the time and earn each other's respect and goodwill. If this is done, the reward is till death do us part, unquote. And that is so true. Lynn Buehling, a book reviewer from Roundup Magazine and a member of the Western Writers of America, states, Arctic Storm is a work of historical fiction written for young adults, but it just might entertain readers of any age. Sundell's knowledge of the Siberian Husky breed shines and gives them a prominent role in this well-written story. Not only well-written, but her genuine love of the Siberian Husky breed shines through. But remember, in Joanne's book series, Watch Eyes, in the Arctic, the ice storm is coming. Joanne, welcome to the Side Vibe.
Thank you so much, Dorothy. You and Robert both for having me on. I appreciate it very much.
Well, first up, I want to say congratulations on the release of Arctic Will, the third installment. I know that just hit the shelves on April 20th. What a great feeling it must be to see that out.
Absolutely. It's been a while in the making, so it's quite exciting. It's almost like not real when, you know, something goes from print and actually gets out, you know, from when you first start writing something. So it's tremendous closure, and I am excited. So thank you.
Well, I'm so excited to talk to you about the trilogy. But first, I wanted to start with a little bit about you, the person behind the pen. You stated that you and your husband started on your bucket list before it was actually a coined phrase. Tell us just a little bit about where some of your travels were from that list and how you felt history came to life before your eyes and how profound of an experience that must be, especially for someone who loves to write historical novels.
Well, you know, in fact, when my husband and I moved to Colorado 40 plus some years ago, and then actually went up to the mountains once all of our children were born, my husband certainly commuted to Denver, but the mountains in Colorado were still quite remote, and you have a sense of isolation on the one hand, and I think historically speaking, moving to the Colorado Rockies and being in the mountains, where the eight different Ute tribes at one time lived, it absolutely started to come to life for me there, the history part. You can still see some of the remnants of the Indians having burned some of the forest before they were driven out. And they were actually the last tribe to go to the reservations in the United States. So it was fascinating. It was because of their remoteness. And that sort of historical perspective just started taking root in my mind, and I was fascinated. And that's where history, I could just hear it, see it in the trees, in the wind. You could hear frontiersmen, pioneers. Might sound kind of nutty, but that's kind of how it was. And then just real quick, if I may say, my husband and I kind of did the reverse of what people do. We decided, if at all we could, we wanted to take our children and start to travel to some of the places that, yes, are on our bucket list. So Mexico, Alaska, Australia, New Zealand, Eastern, Western Europe, Israel, the Caribbean, Fiji, Tahiti, all that sort of thing. What struck me mostly, I mean, obviously in the Middle East, the antiquities are right there. We can all kind of go back in time and living history. It's all right there. But in particular, if I could speak to Antarctica and Alaska, in that it's the remoteness, it's the isolation where you absolutely get a sense that things have not changed over the millennia, and you feel like you're honored to have a little special ability to be part of mankind that sees that part of the world. That's where history comes to life for me. In that
regard.
Yeah, that's
pretty exciting.
Yeah.
When you can sit there and as a writer, of course, you know, we immerse ourselves in this, and to be able to be in the area and feel it and sense it, I think that would be amazing. Let's talk huskies a little bit with you, of course. You've had many Siberian huskies in your life, and you and your husband actually began the husky journey together. Tell us about how you first fell in love with the breed and your first pup, which I believe is Krepelin.
Krepelin.
And what was that captured yours and your husband's heart?
Well, you know, we're in Colorado, and we're thinking, you know, my husband had never had a dog his whole life. When I was a very little girl in the hills of Virginia, we had a rat terrier or something, but never had dogs after that, had cats forever and a day. So we get in Colorado, and we go, wow, this is cold territory. Let's look for a husky. New zilch about the breed. Nothing, except they were cute. So here we are in Pueblo, Colorado, in a little pet shop, all those places where you never go and get dogs, right? And there was this cute little black and white pup in a circus cart. And, oh, let's get that one. The dog brought him home, had no clue. And, of course, you start finding out, as you know, what these dogs are like. And, obviously, the watch eyes captured me. He had blue watch eyes. Almost white, and just really, really, his absolutely adorable good looks got to both of us. But it's that look in the eye. It's that look in the eye where it just melts your heart. So that's what got our husband and my husband and I both onto Siberian Huskies.
I definitely know the look. I mean, once you have the look, I think that's where the potato chip syndrome comes in. Once you look at them, that's it.
Right.
You know, five
Taste
Siberians
one, huh?
later.
Right.
So let's talk for a moment about his name, because I'm always intrigued on how Siberian Huskies are named. And your Husky's moniker was shared by a very influential historical person in the medical world. And
yes.
Am I to assume he was named after Emil Krepelin, the German
psychiatrist? Yes,
yes.
I have to say, you know, my husband being a psychiatrist and I'm a nurse, and we thought, well, you know, we're going to name our dog after the, as you say, the father of modern-day psychiatry, Krepelin, I don't know how you pronounce his name exactly. But so that's how names like Krepelin and Zygmunt and things like that came in. Just like my daughter Zoe, who had wonderful Zifton, all of her animals begin with the letter Z.
So that's how
Zoe ended up with Zifton, and she's a Zoe, and it goes from there. But yes, that's how we came about naming Krepelin, just because psychiatry, my husband, and we just went with that.
I love the roots of names when we get into it and you find out why people name the dog they do. It's just so fascinating. How many puppies have been part of your family?
Eight briefly, seven a long time. One we lost, he was sort of dog napped, we believe, and out running in the hills of Colorado, and the other doggy died within the first year of life, swallowed something he shouldn't have, and there you go. But I would say seven for over 40 years we had for a long, long period of time. In fact, my oldest huskies were 15 and 17 that I had
wonderful.
In the mountains. Yeah.
I love hearing that. You know, that they're, it just seems, I find, unless there are health issues, you know, that like struck Gibson, I just find that the age of huskies seem to be going longer and longer. And I think that's really an attribute to the care that they're getting and being so part of people's families today. Seeing husky birthdays come up, even that we share over on our Facebook
yes.
page, they're 14, 15, 16, 17. Well, like
And, you know, if I could just add to that, I think with the two that I mentioned in particular, Curie and Mesmer, they're dogs that shouldn't have been. They were 2 weeks old when I was given them as a gift, and the mother had not fed them, and they looked like little lab rats. And these were the dogs that shouldn't have been. And those are the two that, you know, baby bottle fed them, had to chew feed them before that. They lived to be the longest. And that's where I must say, I didn't realize it at the time, but I think my respect for this breed must have seeded somewhere there, because I don't know how these animals lived. I mean, yes, we gave them as good care as we could, but they'd really kind of been left for dead, and nobody was going to do anything about it. And they had no nourishment for the first couple of weeks that they were born. So I was fascinated that an animal could live that long. Yeah.
Yeah.
With nothing.
And, you know, I'm going to steal a title from your book. I believe they had that Arctic will, because, you know, even though
yes.
Gibson, I lost him shy of 10, he too was one of those that probably would not have made it because of him being an epileptic dog. I do know that some
yeah.
other puppies and other his mom wound up, they put them down. And so just all the different health challenges he faced, and many people that have followed
yeah.
his story, he really was an inspiration, because he did have that will, and he had a zest for life, and no matter what, you know, what comes before them,
yeah.
these puppies are really
yeah.
amazing. They really are.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
you've also had a gorgeous woolly or long-haired husky.
Like Xander,
my
Xander, yes.
And that's in your photo, and folks, when you do go over to our Dog Works radio page, you'll see a picture of Joanne with two of her huskies, and one of them is Xander. And,
yes.
you know, I'm always shocked and amazed, because, you know, a woolly is technically, folks consider, recessive gene, and there are folks who will actually abandon or euthanize them. They do require some extra care, but I love them. And Gibson was husky smart and just so easygoing and a great family
yes.
pet. What are your thoughts on this?
I agree with you so much. I think, you know, Craplin just looked like, you know, he came out of the wrong side of something. You know, what's he about? The vet in the mountains, he was a very commonsensical vet. And, again, hadn't read on the breed, blah, blah, blah. I didn't know. I just was wondering about him. And when I first took Xander to the vet, he said he's a throwback to old school. He said around the turn of the century that this is what Siberian huskies look like, and that it was bred out. And I imagine it was in some of the lines, because if you go back to actual historical tracings, I'm sure there's chapter and verse on exactly what's going on here. But it sounds like what likely happened is over time, Craplin was a type of husky that this was bred out of him over time for speed, because it was all about breeding these animals for speed, correct, at one point. And so I think that's probably why there aren't so many woolly Siberian huskies that would be considered purebred. You know, they start saying, well, you've got a Malamute or blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of hard to know, because they're all called Alaskan huskies. And I know you and Robert have a lot more technical information on all of this. But it sounds like with Mazander that he was just one of those that, you know, they just hadn't bred that long hair out of him yet. He certainly had all the other markings of a Siberian husky in terms of behavior and attitude and a lot of
mm-hmm.
things that I've read about in other dogs. But I think most of the purebred Siberians were like, what is it, the Spitz family? The Spitz kind of mm-hmm. you know, shorter hair and
shorter hair,
and
the
like
waterproof
the
hair.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
I know with our five Siberian Huskies, they each have unique personalities, of course, and there are some breed similarities. And with Gibson, he
mm-hmm.
was so laid back and easygoing, a bit different from his girl, Harley, who's your traditional
Aww.
Siberian.
Yeah.
And she's the pack's alpha. She's brilliant, but she can be side stubborn. And I know there's a lot of side parents out there nodding their head right now to that. And we say that with love, but they are side stubborn at times. She knows what to do, but sometimes it has to be, you know, on her terms. She has energy I wish I could bottle, even now that she's 11. Where Gib, on the other hand, was so chill. And do you see any
Aww.
Differences, you know, other than the cut, yeah. did you notice, like, the difference in the personality between, like, your woolly and your traditional like that?
You know, I did, and I have to say, you know, as you say, these animals have their own unique personality. And that's what we bond with. That's what we relate to. But I think... I don't know, too, if gender has anything to do with it, if you have a male or a female dog. But certainly, my cat's at my office door trying to get in. No, you're not coming in, Darwin. Sorry about that. He'll jump over hill and dale, and it'll all be over in a moment. So I want to keep talking with you. But with my female, Zelly, who was a traditional, and she was more of a lead dog, very curious, never fearful. She would mix it up. She was a really tough fighter, but she was the lead dog, and she wasn't as playful. Now, Xander, my woolly, he wanted to play all day, all night. Even when he got huge, he would just jump up on you and knock
mm-hmm.
you over. Thought that was the greatest thing. He had some fears. If he would come to any kind of a barrier, he wouldn't pass it. He didn't know what that was or something. I don't know. He had some fears. He was a pack animal, clearly. He was part of a pack. He did not like to be alone. And don't ask me why I feel that way, but he just was miserable if he was alone. And he followed Zelly from day one, and I think... he just didn't want to be alone. And I think those are different. Much stronger, very strong,
they
hard
are
work.
So strong. When you say that, I remember Gibson. Gibson, we called him the little bulldog. Well, he was a little. He was 100 pounds, and that was his good
weight.
Oh, wow. With his medicine,
yeah.
he had shot up to 116, took 2 years, got him back
Aww.
Down. But he was a 100-pound woolly husky, and these guys
Aww.
Knew there wasn't a door, a gate, a doorknob that this boy could not open. And when they all wanted to come in, they would pile behind
wow.
him, and they knew it. They got behind him, and he would take his paw, pop a gate. He'd watch you open a doorknob and then take his paw or his mouth and open a doorknob. He could open
oh,
his screen doors. He used to push
That's
himself
smart.
Out on the deck. It was
Aww.
Funny. And they all get behind him like, okay, let's go. So they
oh,
are very strong.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, they were very strong. In fact, one thing about Xander when he was a pup, he liked to dig. You know, some of these dogs really like to dig.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was Craiglin, rather. Sorry. I'm totally getting a different dog. But these Siberian Huskies, I couldn't believe it when he was a pup. He would play with cinder blocks. He would get these darn things in his mouth and play with them. How can this animal? And I'm sorry, I got off Gibson and Xander for a moment, but I remember wondering how this puppy could get that darn thing along the ground and play with it and put it in his mouth.
They're amazing.
It was amazing
so
to me. But I'm off subject. Sorry about that. Not the first
That's okay.
time I get off subject.
That's right. But actually, while we're talking about woolies, I don't want to take up too much time because we have a lot more to talk about,
sure.
and I want
okay.
to make sure we get it
okay.
all in. But while
right,
we're talking
right,
about
right.
huskies for our listeners, I'm just going to kind of step on my little pulpit box here for a second because I'd like to just share a few care points. Woolies' fur is longer and not, quote, waterproof like the traditional husky coat. Therefore, special care in the snow and wet weather needs to be taken to ensure that
right.
the snow and ice does not build up in their fur, and they need to be
right.
dried well after exposure so to prevent them from freezing, irritation, injury. Woolies, and any husky for that matter, should never, ever be shaved unless specifically for medical reasons. I know we're in that
yeah.
season now where folks take their huskies to groomers or they go ahead and they want to have them shaved because it's hot out. Please don't. The regrowth can be inhibited, even stunted. Husky coats serve as their insulation both in hot weather and cold, as well as protection from the sun and parasites. So folks, you may feel hot looking at a husky, especially a woolly, with all that fur, but please just groom them, never shave. And while Woolies are not accepted as a show dog or breeding, they are not defective dogs. They should not be euthanized. They are amazing, loving dogs who can just as easily pull a sled as they can snuggle up with a family. They really do have personalities, as both Joanne and I have said, as big as their fur is long. So, Joanne, the Watch Eyes trilogy. Arctic Storm, Arctic Shadow, and your newest and final chapter, Arctic Will. You've referred to them as prairie fiction novels, I believe. Can you speak a little bit about that blended genre of writing and maybe tell us exactly what is prairie fiction fantasy?
Well, actually, it was, I should have used the word frontier fiction, because the first book was sold to the publisher because it was a frontier fiction. Sometimes you can't call things westerns or old west or arctic west or whatever, and so it was frontier fiction, and the fantasy kind of was added on because that's in fact what reviewers started to call it a bit, because the book, you know, after the book was written and all, so it wasn't begun as a frontier fiction fantasy. But basically what that is, it's fiction set on the frontier. It could be, you know, the Old West frontier. In my case, for my books, it was Siberian and the Alaska frontier. And then with fantasy elements. So, and fantasy is its own genre, like suspense and all. But I would say that's the best description. Frontier, fiction set on the frontier with elements of fantasy. There you go.
Now, if you're just tuning in, this is the Side Vibe on DogWorks Radio. We're talking with author Joanne Sundell, whose latest book is Arctic Will, the final installment of her Watch Eyes trilogy that was just released this month, with the two books, with her two first books being Arctic Storm and Arctic Shadow. You can check out these books and other books by Joanne on her website, which is www.joanne, that's J-O-A-N-N-E, Sundell, S-U-N-D-E-L-L.com. And she also has a blog there that's really interesting to read. You can also follow her on her author Joanne Sundell community Facebook page. And links to these sites are also going to be listed on our show's website at dogworksradio.com/the-vibe.com. And we'll also be in an upcoming blog post I'm going to be doing with a little bit different of a Q&A that Joanne and I had done earlier. And I'm going to be posting that with links to this show, and that'll be over on 5sides.blogspot.com. And I'll also be putting links and notices of this over on our 5sides Siberian Husky Canine News and Reviews Facebook page. Joanne, you've written a number of books before the Watch Eyes trilogy, and they were historical romances and westerns. And I know you and I share a passion for the Old West, which is always fun. With Watch Eyes, it was, while still steeped in history, which is your specialty, a detour into fantasy, I believe. And I really admire authors who can create these worlds and languages weave today. I mean, we've fallen in love with these different stories and addicted to, such as the Harry Potter books, your Game of Thrones, even the series Outlander, which is based on books. And they all capture our attention and our imagination. And I just find it so fascinating and amazing to read these stories with this element, let alone even try to think about writing one. And in Watch Eyes, there is such a fantastical, mystical element to it set against the true history of the Siberian Husky. How difficult was it to create this fictional fantasy world?
Well, actually, I didn't set out to do that. What happened is, if we go back to my love for historical, anything historical, and once I knew I wanted to write about the history of the Siberian Husky, and it was that research that led me to this fantasy world, which was a combination of the Chukchi world and the Viking world and all the mythology that comes with the Vikings. And a lot of it was due to the part of the world it was set in. Set, the history of the Siberian Husky started in far northeast Siberia, in the cold, above the Arctic Circle, and certainly the Vikings traveled all of those waters, including many other waters. But so it was that mythology and that fantasy spiritual world of both of those, the Chukchi and the Vikings, that sort of misted down and settled over my doggies and how their story was playing out. So the characters came out of that. But I must tell you, I am absolutely a fan of Harry Potter, read every book, love it, love it. And I'm just such a fan of Rowling. And I wonder, you know, if you'd ask her, but it might be interesting of how all that world started and came about. It's very interesting, and I appreciate you asking that question. But my fantasy world, it just seemed to be a natural spiritual evolution from the history of these dogs. They are magical, 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 and that was proven to me because that came out in the story, and they wrote that, as far as I'm concerned.
I totally understand that. That's what I think as writers, that's exactly what happens. Sometimes you start out with a nugget of an idea, or you have your concept, or you may have the beginning, middle, or end in your head, but it seems mm-hmm. almost like it starts to, at a point, it kind of writes itself for you as well.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
You dip into these areas mm-hmm. where you're like, ooh, I didn't even know I was going there, you know, so it's
right.
very exciting. And I love hearing, especially, you know, in the field that you write in, it's just so fascinating to me.
Aww,
now,
well.
Did you know when you set out to write Arctic Storm that it would be a trilogy?
No. Again, if I go back to the history part, I had about 20 years of historical action and relevance when things started coming down on the Siberian Husky in Siberia and leading to the Alaska frontier. And in trying to reconcile those 20 years in some kind of a story, even though this was fiction, I really wanted to be true to history. So that's what I just couldn't have these things happen where you snap your fingers and suddenly it's 10 years mm-hmm. later, if that makes
right.
any sense. So to bring in all these historical elements from Siberia and Russia and what was going on with everything that was going on the Alaska frontier and with Nome and all of that, it was very, you know, with the beginning of the heyday of sled dog racing in Alaska, I just couldn't do it. And, you know, really the hammer started coming down on the Huskies in 1930 is in effect what happened in Siberia is when the hammer really came down on this breed. And so I was just trying to be a little true to history, so it took three books to, you know, to try and tell that in a reasonable, realistic way. And I tried to thread a romantic story in to kind of
yes,
help hold the reader's interest.
Now, while doing your research on the Siberian Husky, which you state interestingly, and I'm going to quote, today's AKC registered Siberian Husky breed all come from the 114 original mm-hmm. Huskies imported to Frontier, Alaska. The importation
right.
to America saved the Siberian Husky, and that's the end of your quote. Can you tell our readers about what you discovered in the breed's history about about why the breed being saved that not only captured your attention but was the catalyst for writing, you know, what you were talking about, writing about them in these books?
Well, you know, I certainly can. I really, you know, most of my books, all of my previous books, strong female heroines. I'm always looking for female heroines breaking ground on the frontier. So when my last husky died, it was about the same time that I was trying to get my teeth into a book in Nome and that area because I found out that 1 in 10 of the folks that went there to get gold were women. So I was interested in that. But then what happened is as I started to research, I thought, well, you know, there are a lot of sled dogs around here. And it just sort of seemed like a healing thing for me to do to just go across the water there and research about the beginnings of the Siberian Husky, and I thought that would just help me with losing my dogs. And I found out almost right away in my history research that Joseph Stalin, because of industrialization and collectivization related to communism, you know, he killed not only millions and millions of people, but he basically ordered the execution of the Chukchi dog owners, breeders, and Chukchi dogs, because they were the only ones, you know, when communism was coming down the pike and all the Chukchi people, just like the Utes in Colorado, were the last to go to the reservation. The Chukchi people in native Siberia were the last that the communists were able to put down. Hundreds of years before the Tsar, the Cossacks. Nobody could catch them or get them, and they always escaped because of their dogs. The Chukchi people survived always because of their dogs. So it was very important to Stalin to get rid of their dogs so he could destroy the people because they were getting in his way for getting all the riches in that part of Siberia. But also Stalin wanted a big, fat, woolly, mammoth, strong freight dog for his industrialized Russia. And Siberian Huskies had no part in that world to him. They were nothing. They were weak. They were bleh, who needs them? And that's also one of the reasons he wanted them all gone, because they weren't part of his strong Russia that he was going to create. So those two things together, things about the Siberian Husky, and he actually followed through, and he actually was able to do away with that breed. And they're, you know, over the past recent years, they're reintroducing the Siberian Husky back to Russia, which is amazing to me. But in the history, were it not for the early importations of the Siberian Husky to the frontiers of Alaska, this purebred Siberian Husky would not have survived, and we would not have them today. And we might talk about it a little bit later, but Leonard Cipolla, the famous, most famous dog driver in all of Alaska, he took two groups of his Siberian Huskies, which from Alaska to Maine, I believe it was, and it was out of those kennels that the foundation for the AKC registered Siberian Husky. That's the foundation we have right now. And interestingly enough, in 1930, that's when the AKC recognized the Siberian Husky, and that's also the year that Joseph Stalin began making sure there would be no more Siberian Huskies. So I thought, well, there's something in that. I'm probably going long on this, and I do apologize for that. So
Some things just can't be shortened.
thank you. Yes, right.
You know, I love the books that weave facts and fiction, and I know in the process you're writing, we talked about, the history of the Husky was really what kind of prompted the whole thing. And, you know, then the fantasy element came in after that. And I also enjoy character development. When I read, I want to, you know, when I read, I want to see my characters and become part of their world. And I have to ask, how did Anya, who is your Chukchi shaman in the book, and also your lead strong female role model, and Rune, your two main characters, aside from the Huskies, come to life?
Well, you know, if we could just go back for a moment to, I was trying to research about the Chukchi people and about the Vikings and all. And then I was, of course, my primary focus is on the history of the Siberian Husky and how all of this played out for them. So what I found out about the Chukchi people, women, it was very tough on women for a long time. They were allowed to call those pups from the litters that they felt were not going to measure up. But for the most part, it was a man's world in terms of the Siberian Husky. So, but oddly enough, even though women were they were treated not very well by the Chukchi, their life was very hard, I guess, is what I mean by that. It was a very, very hard life for them. Okay, so, but women, girls were allowed to be shamans, which, you know, the shamans are the most revered spiritual person in the tribe. Mm-hmm. So I was fascinated by that, and I said, well, Anya could have Russian roots, and if this little girl, who she's 13 when the first book opens, if this girl is somehow naturally becomes a shaman, she is someone who lives in many worlds, because if you look into the Chukchi people, they're very spiritual people, and they believe everything has a spirit, and they are an animistic people, and they believe that, you know, animals could take on the form of a human shape. So there I had my idea. Anya's going to be a medium. She's Russian. She can speak in both worlds, but she's part white, which is part Russian, and part Chukchi. Her mother would be Chukchi. But I wanted this young heroine to go against the grain, and she is by nature a shaman, and her stepfather is going to oppose that 100%. But she naturally has an ability to work with these dogs where other little girls were not allowed to do it. And so her stepfather allows her to work with these animals because she's so good with them. He's an elite dog breeder. And then Rune certainly, not only for a love interest, but it just made sense to me that in that world of the Viking ships and above the Arctic Circle and exploring Norway, all of that sort of thing, that in these waters you could very well have a young man whose family has a very wealthy concern out of Seattle, shipping and all. And this young kiddo wants to go up north like so many did, to go up to Nome for gold and so many things. But he would likely, he is somebody that could likely have been in those waters and could been there and have encountered Anya because of the trade and the communication between Siberia and Alaska at that time. So that's how all that came
about.
And
at this point, I would like to know how many of our readers are going, I need to read those books. You know, as the more you talk about this, it's so fascinating. And the different worlds, it's just really, they're amazing reads. And as I said earlier about husky names and being a writer and a reader, I'm always intrigued, as we said, about names. So I know that when writing, you can sense right away if a name does or does not fit your character. How did you come up with their names? And can you talk about, you know, talk about briefly, like, how did you get to know your characters first before naming them, or did their names actually come from them to you?
Huh, that's a very interesting question. Well, certainly I was going to use Zelly and Xander because those were my last two dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted those names in there, hell or high water. So I knew those names from the get-go, and those names were used from the get-go. But then, you know, in book one, oh, God, let me see if my memory will allow me to go back and revisit book one. But I had, the only fictional name I used was Boris the Bear. He was the Russian fur trader that I have bringing the first imports to Alaska, to the frontier. And when you read the books, you can see how Anya and Rune became a part of that. And those dogs, those huskies, that it all started at the Markova Fair and Anadar, where the dogs are being sold, and Anya had to go and try and get her doggies. It was tough. She wanted to be with them. And they were all going to be imported and go to America. And so some of these dogs started to gather from different groups. Some were her stepfather's dogs, a couple were other dogs, and they were all Siberian huskies, however, purebred. So they go from the Markova Fair in Anadar, Siberia, over to the Alaska frontier. So they, and I guess along about the middle of book one, they start to give names because Anya wanted to name them all. And oh, let me see if I can remember. Shamans in the Chichki tribe would, they basically get high in order to go into their trances so they could tell the tribe they're speaking to spirits and all. And to do that, they would eat these big white mushrooms with red spots all over them. And so I had, mushroom and, not midday. Boy, you know, it's terrible when you can't remember. I had midday, midnight, but mushroom and what was her other name? Oh, magic. Of course magic, because it was magic.
Perfect name. Now,
my
they,
brain. So magic and mushroom,
you,
because they were copper, red, and white huskies. That's why I named them. They really loved the mushroom. And then flowers was sort of a spotted doggy, so look like spring flowers when the Arctic melts a little bit. And then magic, I mean, midday and midnight, midnight black husky, midnight basically white husky. Frost was basically a gray. And then little wolf was sort of a runt and had more wolf-like look to him and all. So that's where all the names came from. But they
that's
didn't really get
it.
Assigned names until about the middle of the book. But I... Sorry, I was, my brain, I'm telling you, it's big.
No, that's okay. And if I'm only working on one cup of coffee, sometimes I totally trip over myself, and a lot of
well,
my readers know.
Well, you know, I skip around with names toward the end, and more doggies' names came in toward the end, and I get a little confused. But anyway, those are the names of the doggies that in book one, about midway through the book, Onion had them all
named. It's always
fun
to hear how the names came. You know, it's just great. And especially when there's many, you know, you have to go, wow, how did these names come? So it's kind of cool. So now for those who didn't read the book, as they're reading it, they'll know the origins of the dog's names. Now, Watch Eyes is a fantasy, a historical, a romance, all rolled up into like three fabulous installments. And with all, there's typically a good versus bad element. And here, and it is here. So tell us about the origins of Gollum and its evil spark, and how difficult or easy was it to write the dark side to a book? And third part of that is, and did you know the outcome of the book while you were researching the history, or did that unveil itself to you as you were writing it?
Well, if I can answer that with when I was doing research, it was when I read, I think it's the historian Robert Conquest who wrote, was writing the history of Russia or something. And I had been struggling prior to this with good versus evil, bad spirits, good spirits, blah, blah, blah. What am I doing here? But the moment I read that Robert Conquest assigned a description to Joseph Stalin, if he is like a golem, who is like a clay-like figure. And in Jewish mysticism, a golem can be, I believe, good spirits or bad spirits. But as soon as I saw Joseph Stalin described as being like an evil spark was born within him, there you went. Everything just took off. And that just made it all possible. It was like the Red Sea parting, in that you have all of the spiritual world of the Chukchi, and they absolutely believed everything had a spirit, and all of these other worlds were going on in the universe at the same time there. And then when I know what Joseph Stalin did, it was very easy for me to understand or to assign the fact that he was able to breach all of these worlds because of his evil. He was physically doing evil on Earth to the Siberian Huskies in Siberia, but he was also able to go into the spirit world where Anya could go also, and where the Viking world also exists in that spirit world. Call it Valhalla, call it whatever. But Joseph Stalin's evil golem counterpart was able to take those dark spirits and cause mayhem here on Native Earth. I call Frontier Alaska Native Earth, Siberia. So that's when I broke the worlds down, and that's kind of how everything played out.
Now,
so that the reader exists in all these worlds, too, right along with us. Hopefully.
Right along with them. Right. You really do go right along the ride. Now, your trilogy titled Watch Eyes, which I know you had mentioned earlier when we first were introducing you, also has great meaning directly associated with the Siberian Husky. So can you just tell our readers what that title means and how you came up to using it for the series?
Well, my daughter Zoe, who you have very kindly let Zipton be in your book, Zoe said one day, why don't you just call it Watch Eyes Trilogy? Because of the watch eyes of the Siberian Husky. And as you know, with Siberian Huskies, they can have heterochromic eyes, which is patches of different pigments on their eyes, and they're all still really showable and all. It does nothing to affect their value in the breed. But watch eyes, to my understanding, watch eyes refers to the whitish blue eyes, almost, of the Siberian Husky. So that's why it's called Watch Eyes Trilogy, because of that, because my daughter Zoe said, call it Watch Eyes Trilogy. And I said, yeah, I'm going to.
Yes. Now, you know, something I wanted to just ask quickly, how long did it take to write, and I say story, which is actually, you know, the three books itself, because I know it was a story for you before it was broken up into the three. So how long to write?
Listen, on average, let's see. It takes,
you know what, Joanne, I'm just losing you a little bit.
I'm sorry. Is that better?
Yes, much. Thank you.
Sorry. That's what I did to Robert last time, and I still feel awful about that. I forgot what I was trying to say here.
About
what question
writing.
Were we on? Oh,
we were
about
talking
writing, about
how long.
Oh, I forgot how long I write. No. Just it usually takes a couple of months to do the research. And then the book just kind of went Timu Mazuma. They really did. So I think I would say it took me 3 to 4 months to do each book, if that.
Wow, interesting. I got to tell you, that's admirable. Sometimes I'm thinking about mine for 3 to 4 months.
Well, because the story was going, and I had already laid the research foundation. So, and what I do, I don't know what your style is at all, you know, but what I do is I don't write much ahead or think much ahead. As you can tell from the when you interviewed me, I can't remember what I was talking about 2 seconds ago. No,
I tend to.
Oh, well, you are very nice. I appreciate that. But I tend to not know the ending. I tend to go with the research, and each day I see what's up, comes on the page that day. It kind of just happens that way because of all the research is in the back of my mind. But if I could just say really quickly, I thought I had finished book 300%, sent it all in, and I got this sort of knock on the email door from the publisher going, Joanne, do you want to finish the story? And I didn't even realize, Dorothy, I had taken everything up to the critical mass moment, and I just ended it. And you know what? I don't know if it was I was grieving over my doggies. I didn't want to say goodbye to them. It was so weird, but I just stopped the story, and I didn't. It took the prompting from the publisher to say, and then I said, okay, and I was so upset. I thought, how am I going to get back into this? It's been months. And my gosh, Dorothy, it was very bizarre. Like, my doggies were sitting right here. I started writing, and I bet that I did that in like 2 or 3 days, 3 chapters.
Wow. That's pretty
amazing. It's bizarre because I didn't want it to end, I guess. But anyway, I was getting emotional.
I guess, you know what, that's probably very true. Because I think as long as we're writing, then everything's still there, you know. So, but then through
words. I hope
so. Yeah, they always are. But I think it is hard to put, it's exciting and hard to put one to bed, so to say, because you become so close to it. It's like your little world for a while that, you know, it's kind of a double-edged sword. It's like you're thrilled to get it out there, but there's part of you that's sad because, you know, now you're like, oh, okay, you know, I'm done here. But for any of our listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is the Side Vibe on Dog Works Radio. We're talking with author Joanne Sundell, whose latest book is Arctic Will, the final installment of her Watch Eyes trilogy that was just released this month, with her first two books being Arctic Storm and Arctic Shadow. You can check out these books and other books by Joanne on her website over at www.joannesundell.com. And she also has a great blog over there. It's really worth taking a look at. A lot of interesting things she writes about on that. You can also follow her on her author Joanne Sundell community Facebook page. And links to both of these sites, Robert and I will both have them listed for this show at dogworksradio.com/the-vibe.com. And we'll be coming up soon in a blog post over at 5sides.blogspot.com and on my 5sides Siberian Husky Canine News and Reviews page. And I also just want to let listeners know we're getting near the end of our live hour, but even though if the show cuts off for you, please come back. We'll be posting a permalink later on tonight because we will be continuing on with our conversation with Joanne. So I just want to let our listeners know that. So, Joanne, what is it about the Siberian Husky that dates back to their origins that is so magical and lends itself as a perfect backdrop to your books? We know their eyes are definitely fetching, but there's so much more, right?
Well, their history is a very spiritual, enduring one, and it's intertwined absolutely with the Chukchi people. In fact, these dogs are the Chukchi dogs, and thousands of years of breeding and coming from such an impossible place to live. And that's why it was the perfect backdrop for my book. It's remote, and it's impossible odds, much like a lot of Alaska and a lot of Antarctica. So that was fascinating to me, and that seemed to play out in their history, absolutely, that they survived when the average dog breed, I dare say, would not survive. But it was also due to a bond with the Chukchi people. It took both of them to create the Chukchi dog.
And how important of a role was the Aurora Borealis, that beautiful artwork in the sky?
Oh.
That's on my bucket list to see someday. But I know that was an important role.
Right. Well, you know, the Chukchi, as I said, were very spiritual people. And they had, you know, they lived in a universe where they believed that many other universes were coexisting. So the heavens certainly were very important. The depths below, very important. The waters, they had like 13 or 15 seasons in their year, and everything, they're like their survival, because there were no points of reference pretty much anywhere except the heavens and the horizon. And so they really were able to read the stars. In fact, they believed, you know, in the Creator God, and they believed there was a pole star in the heavens where spirits could get through and go to other worlds, and this is how the shamans travel to other worlds and all. So they were always wind directions. The morning dawn was the most important wind of the Chukchi, and all of their doors in their homes faced this direction. But they believed in the Arctic winds. That was the music of the people. So the Aurora Borealis, I didn't find anything that specifically says they played a particular role, but I think taken together, because of the nature of where they lived and how much of the year the Aurora Borealis was right up there. And I'm certain they had to believe that those were spirits shooting across heaven. They had to believe it. And when meteors rain down and all, I think they all thought that was true.
Oh, I think we're losing you again. We lost you a little bit there.
Oh, I'm sorry. I keep doing that. Thank you for being there.
It's the nature of cell phones.
Well, I tend to go off track, and I am sorry. But anyway, I think the heavens had to have played an amazing part in their lives, because their survival depended on being able to read what was happening with the weather and knowing the directions of where they were. So they really had to be in tune with nature there. So I'm sure that the Aurora Borealis had to, you know, absolutely had tremendous meaning
right.
for them.
And my next question actually brings us to a question about heaven, but I just want to remind our listeners that when we do click off the live air, be sure to come back, because we're going to be talking about Leonard Sepala and Togo and the role he's playing in this book. That's a lot of fascinating information coming from there. We're also going to talk about the Alaska Sweepstakes in 1909, so please come back, because there's a lot of good stuff still ahead. But, Joanne, can you also talk about who the gatekeepers are, the two Siberians who guard the gates of heaven?
Oh, yes. Well, the Chukchi people, being very spiritual people, they believed that two of their dogs guarded the gates of heaven. And these two Siberian huskies who guard the gates of heaven, or Chukchi dogs, will let you in or not. And the Chukchi believed that when their dogs died, their dogs would pass the gatekeepers and they would sleep in heaven, so that when the Chukchi themselves died, their dogs would pull them across, would help pull their sled across to heaven. Oh, that always got to me. They had a very spiritual relationship there. So the gatekeepers, but if you were treated a dog badly in your lifetime, if you did anything to, because they depended on their dogs for survival, if you did anything to harm a dog, you would not be allowed into heaven. So that's why the gatekeepers, and that's who they are. And so that fascinated me, their belief system in that. And it showed you, too, how much they thought of their dogs.
Absolutely.
They believed in them for their life. Yeah.
Now, when I was introducing you, I left people with the quote, "The ice storm is coming." So can you talk a little bit about your reference to that?
Well, I keep referring to that actually in all three books, because I try to bring the reader in as soon as it makes sense to, there's something that Anya, there's a reason Anya needs to take action as a shaman. There is a reason her dogs are being taken from their home. What's happening? What's going to happen to them? There is something bad coming, and her grandmother who dies appears to her spiritually, and everything references to this. She knows there is something, there's a bad end coming, and she is the one actually who is chosen, which you find out in different ways. I'm not giving too much away here, but all of the Siberian ancestry and the generations of gods before are all end up counting on her, and she is more or less a guardian. She's appointed as a guardian of these dogs, and it's part of her responsibility to foster them to some kind of safety. But there is an evil that is befalling the land. There is an evil that is befalling her people and these dogs, and she carries that bird, and that's where the story takes you. But that's the ice storm. The ice storm is coming refers to that, because We knew it was coming, and I knew it was coming because, we know what the end that the communists wanted for these dogs. So that's what the ice storm references.
Now,
I sort of try to allude to that.
Yes, and definitely. And it kind of is it kind of keeps you going, okay, so when, it's very, very intriguing. And with the extensive research that you've done on the history, and I know we talked earlier about that, what historical fact about the husky trait did you find the most intriguing? And what traits from those ancestors do you still find in the breed today?
Boy, the most intriguing? I'll tell you, I guess there's just one word that keeps jumping out, respect, respect, respect. I have such respect for this animal. I haven't done that much research about other breeds. But I don't know if you could just pull out of a hat any other dog where, were it not for them, an entire people would not have been able to survive. So they really are the reason that the Chukchi people survived, because of them. And so I have tremendous respect. And through all of this, fast, strong, and enduring, which a lot of Huskies are described as that, but... I think the fact these dogs had to be so hardy and they had to endure such difficult conditions, very little food, and, if a hunter was out 100 miles over ice or something, they had to be able, these dogs had to be able to get them back home. So it was very tough on these dogs, but they were loyal, they were valiant. But I think the idea that they could still be so gentle, and, when these animals were run in sled formation, was in the fan formation, because they had so much room there. The dogs could all fan way out. Certainly it was when you got to the Alaska frontier, these animals had to learn to be in harness 2x2 because the trails weren't as wide and all that. So I was very interested in that, but they had to get along or they would fight and the Chukchi people would be out on the limb. They'd be out 100 feet over ice and these 100 miles, and these animals were fighting, and they couldn't get them home. So they had to be gentle. They had to be gentle. They had to get along. So that is another thing, too, that amazes me, that these very rugged, strong animals who are so hardy are also quite gentle. Other breeds may be attributed to three dog night, but I read so many resources where the Chukchi would bring the animals in only inside at night, or the children, if it was particularly harsh and cold, and depending on how cold, they would bring in one, two, or three dogs to keep the children warm. Otherwise, they didn't sleep inside. So anyway.
I just have to give a shout-out to Jeanette and Faith DeBaldo, who just actually texted me, and hopefully she doesn't mind me saying this, but she said, wow. She's bummed that she couldn't finish listening to the live show, and she can't wait to finish listening.
Oh.
And she said, fantastic show. Oh, my goodness, I loved hearing about it. So I just thought I'd let you know that. I thought that was pretty cool, and thank you,
Faith.
Oh,
that makes me feel good.
Thank
you. That is so
thank
kind.
You, Jeanette and Faith.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that, too. Absolutely.
Yeah, that was quite nice. In Arctic Will, you also write about the Alaska Sweepstakes of 1909. Can you tell us what went into the decision to include that in the story?
Well, it's very much part of the history of why these dogs are still with us today. 1907 is when the Nome Kennel Club was founded. 1908 is when the Siberian Husky was first imported to the Alaska frontier. 1909, okay, and then the all Alaska sweepstakes were begun in Alaska by the Nome Kennel Club to be run every year in April, because not only was skiing a big thing, but sled dog racing, giving people something to do, a payoff in April, blah, blah, blah. Betting was quite heavy. But this race became very famous very quickly. And so what this fur trader who imported these dogs to Alaska in 1908, maybe we can enter these dogs in this race. And that's exactly what happened, really, in 1908, 1909, 1910, 1909 and 1910, I believe, was the year Iron Man Johnson three teams that Fox Mall Ramsey, who is a Scot in Nome, who all of these people are real people that existed in history. But the 1908, 1909, 1910, the way these animals performed in these races is in fact what got them any attention, these purebred dogs. And what got, because you know, Nome called these animals Siberian rats. They thought they were worthless, kind of like Stalin. They certainly were not about to execute them, no, but they just poo-pooed them. They're small. They're not going to do well. Well, guess what? Siberian Husky started to do very well. And Iron Man Johnson in 1910 was one of the three teams that were entered, and these teams finished first, second, and fourth, which is absolutely amazing, these Siberian Huskies, and that's what put them on the map forever. That and later Leonard Topalov, who 1915, 16, and 17 won the All-Alaska Sweepstakes with his beloved Siberian Huskies because he was a natural with them. He was just wonderful
and,
with these
and
dogs.
And speaking of Topalov, Topalov and Togo, who we know played a pivotal role in the 1925 Serum Run in Alaska, had a real impact on you, so much so, you know, that he does show up in your book. So can you tell us about the decision to include him in the story as himself and not basing a character on him?
Well, let's go back to the spiritual nature of all of this. Leonard Topalov had a bond with Siberian Huskies like no other sled dog driver that you can read about in Alaska had at the time. He was very short. He was this little diminutive guy of 5 feet, but he had something with these animals. And he also, I think, learned very quickly on that you don't run these animals ragged. He didn't want to bring any harm to these animals because the first time he tried to enter them in the race, he got off track and almost, you know, his team almost died. And he never forgave himself, really, I don't think, for their paws being bloodied and everything else. He just thought that was awful. He would never put them in harm's way again. I think that was 1914. But in any event, with Leonard Topalov, Anya was a guardian of the Siberian Husky. Rune becomes a guardian of the Siberian Husky. And the only thing on Earth that could possibly have any impact on the evil golem and the villainy after these Siberian Huskies, there's a third guardian because it's in the hands of humans that these animals are going to be saved. It can't be by something spiritual from the heavens or something. So Leonard Topalov very soon became for me the basically the guardian, the hero basically of the third book because he was so impactful on the Siberian Husky, and I honestly believe he was single-handedly responsible for this animal being so recognized and so well-known today. And certainly the foundation is based on the dogs that he brought to Maine. But I don't know if you want me to get into Togo real quickly or any of that.
I was going to mention, I know you wrote a blog piece about it, too, about history getting wrong. So I actually was going to ask you, you know, how we can best honor Sepala and Togo today. You know, of course, while still honoring, and I'm going to say more famous because he was, via the media, more famous Balto, but how to keep the correct history alive.
Well, you know, I think that's happening. I found that people that are really in the dog world do understand that it was Togo and not Balto. But what I felt shame on Disney for doing this with Balto is certainly they have historians that would get the history because it's right there. You don't have to go too deep to find out exactly who ran what, where, when, why, and how. I guess because Balto ran that last 53 miles, and part of that was because Gunnar Kasern just kept him going, and it's kind of murky about why, when, or whatever, but just statistically speaking, Togo ran about 250 miles of that dreaded mileage for the Serum Run, just almost blind, and never was able to race after the Serum Run. But Topalov, you know, depended on Togo to get all of this done, and no animal, the average dog, there were 150 dogs that ran the Serum Run about, they averaged about 35 or 40 miles. None ran over 50. Balto ran 53, and yes, he was the last one that came in. And he was one of Topalov's dogs, actually, that had been left behind in this. So it wasn't that Topalov didn't want Balto to get, you know, what he needed, but in terms of the fame for this, but it broke Leonard Topalov's heart because he knew that Togo gave her all. I think she was 12 at the time. He was 12 at the time. Just gave all and through over the Norton Sound and through impossible stuff and just kept going. And that's what broke his heart, that this sort of Walt Disney doggy got all, and even in books later. And it's a shame, but I think now history's sort of being corrected. And what I can say is people that know the history and all and are learning more about the history can honor both dogs.
Right.
And all of them, you know, did an amazing thing.
Job.
But it personally broke Leonard Topalov's heart. I guess that was what I would like people to know why.
And they can
because,
read more about
you know,
this
and
on
Hollywood
your...
just sort of made a decision on doing that. I don't know if they were lazy or if they just thought Balto is going to get more glory, because certainly the information was out there. I guess that was a question I'd like to ask somebody at this institution. Why didn't
and
we
for
look
our
a little deeper?
And for our listeners, they can always check out your website because you do have a blog on there that has some very interesting posts about this. Now, I also wanted to say, and this is another quote, and this comes right from the book. It's, the dogs do not belong to me. They belong to the winds, to the tundra, and to the ice. They are Tchotchke. They have no master. And Anya said this in Arctic Shadow, I believe, the second installment.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I think this really sums up the spirit and the will of the Siberian Husky. I mean, I'm thinking, you know, T-shirt, mugs, bumper stickers. This is, like, amazing. It really does beautifully depict their nature as a whole. And they really are beautiful, mystical, magical, majestic animals, aren't they?
Well, I think you and I know they are, because we look into our doggy's eyes, and you really know they are. They are a part of this horizontal timeline of history. And I see dogs today as being dogs thousands of years ago or in the future, God willing. But, yes, these animals don't belong to us. They belong to the winds, the tundra, and the ice. And I think that that's where their respect should come from.
And you know what?
We
like
should respect them for that.
We all lose our dogs, which, as you've spoken, is very difficult. Folks know I recently lost Gibson. And if you think of this, that they do belong to the winds, and I'd like to think of it as a full circle, that Gibson's now back in the winds and his spirit's always around, as is with all of our dogs we lose. And I think that just kind of brings that full circle. Now, Joanne, I know I want to wrap this up and I want to pull Robert in for a quick minute, but I loved the trilogy. I can see this as a miniseries. I don't know if anyone's approached you yet to set this to the smaller silver screen, but I think that would be pretty exciting. And I know we've talked about this after your first book, but now that all three books have come out, what do you hope readers walk away with knowing about the Siberian Husky breed and the amazing and intense human-canine bond?
Wow. I think it's that respect. It is that special. They are a very special dog, I believe. And I think respect for the history that each of these dogs represents, and treat them accordingly. Take the best care you can and know that they don't belong to you, really. They belong to that continuum of time, which is part of their history, and you're very lucky to be a part of that. If you are fortunate enough to have Siberian Huskies in your lives, you're able to touch the parts that has gone on before and then will go on past you. And I think that's that magical spiritual moment.
That's really beautiful. Yeah.
Well, absolutely. So.
And we're very fortunate.
Yeah. And, you know, this is a silly little thing, but I keep my dogs, my last two dogs, I keep their harnesses and their little, all their dog tags and all on my little sort of like jingle bell thing in my office. And I can't start my day until I come down and I jingle those. I just move them, and once I hear a certain level of the bells going, I know my doggies are in step for the day.
Yeah.
There's a certain sound that I'd always hear with them from them when I go out to join with them or whatever. So I wait for that sound, and then I go on with my day. Now, how crazy is that?
I don't think it's crazy at all, because every night when I say goodnight to each of my dogs, I still say goodnight to Gibson. And Robert, I know you're out there. I have one final wrap-up question for Joanne, but I just wanted to see if there's anything you wanted to add, because I know, thank you for letting us go over a little bit, but I wanted to kind of see if you had any thoughts or anything you wanted to add.
Well, my only question, Joanne, and I know we've spoke several times on my show, but my only question is, what's next? Now that the books are done, the last book is out, What are you planning on next? What's in your next bag of tricks?
And I have to just—I just want to jump in and say that is my last question. So Robert and
we're many
states apart, but we think the same.
Great mind. No, and Robert, I do want to thank you very much for allowing me to be on your show. It's just such an honor. I'm just so excited because you're up there where it's really all still going on, and you're making history. You with your team and all, and so it's very exciting for me to talk to the both of you. But it's very hard for me to leave the Northland. You know, I keep trying to get out of Alaska or something, and it's hard for me. I'm really focusing on the time of the Yukon Gold Rush, which goes right out of Skagway and Dyea over to Dawson and go in those gold fields. I'm fascinated by the idea that over 100,000 people tried to get to those gold fields, and only about 30,000 made it. I'm fascinated by the trips out of Dyea and the trips out of Skagway over Chilkoot and White Pass. What the heck, with so much humanity there? And I'm also fascinated about the Palm Sunday avalanche that happened there, and survival or not. And you bet, it's taking me to thoughts of this whole spiritual thing and the possibilities of other worlds kind of going on. I don't want to get out into fantasy land too much. I really don't. But I'm really interested in the history there because, too, and I think there are so many ghost towns in the Old West and semi-ghost towns. And in Alaska, there are ghost towns and semi-ghost towns. Dyea is a total ghost town. And Skagway is a semi-ghost town. Well, I'm fascinated by that. Ghost town, what does that mean? Is ghost town some sort of portal to actually what other stuff going on that might not totally turn off lovers of history, because I don't want to get out there. But I'm really interested to see if that line of thinking and that research is going to take me anywhere. Is there a portal through Dyea or through Skagway?
I'm intrigued. How about you, Robert?
I just don't know. And romance, yeah. You know, I'm into that romance. But catastrophic things happen. And with so much humanity being there for like 2 years, that's it. You know, it's where Jack London was and all these people. And then, poof, they're gone. And all of the tumult that went on in that part of the world, all the thousands of animals that freaking died. So I'm fascinated by that. What happened? Well, and is all that gone? So that's where my thinking is, guys. Call me crazy.
Well, Joanne, if you haven't had a chance to visit Skagway or even Dawson, those are places that fit right into that narrative. And there's a heck of a lot of history there in southeast Alaska and then right over the Chilkoot Trail there. All of those people, I'm sure most of you guys have seen those pictures or the documentaries where thousands of people just strapped everything they could on their back and they worked their way over that pass and into Canada in search for that gold. So it's a very interesting story, not only for the United States, because so many of them came into Alaska beforehand, but also history of North America and how, you know, that gold rush played so much into, you know, what formed us as a nation.
Robert, you know what's always bothered me, too, though, about the sled dog, whether it's hundreds of years before in Canada or things that happened during gold rush days to horses, to dogs. Why is it, I'm having a lot of trouble forgiving pioneers for what they did to dogs and what they did to horses. I understand financial times in the United States right before then were horrible, kind of like now. People didn't have a lot of money. They wanted to go get money. I get that. But the treatment of animals, I don't get it. And thank God the value in Alaska, it seems like the people in Alaska always got it, the value of their sled dogs. You always got it. and you always treated them accordingly. But I'm having trouble forgiving people during Gold Rush Day, so to speak, of what they did, the cruelty to animals. Does that sound nutty? I'm looking for answers about why or how that all happened. I probably sound very naive.
No, it's not nutty at all. You know, I live in a community that probably has five times more dogs than it does people. So there's a lot of sled dogs here in our community. Yeah. And I would venture to guess that 99.9% of those folks put their dogs first. You know, at least mm-hmm. here at our kennel, we're fortunate enough to have, you know, the resources to be able to care for them as best as we possibly can. You know, we always make sure that the dogs are taken care of first, whether mm-hmm. that includes, you know, the pleasures in life, whatever that may be, or whatever. And I think that at least in today's day and age, in particular in Alaska, we recognize that. And boy, mm-hmm. if you're found out to be mistreating your dogs in any way, you're very quickly ousted and blacklisted in the community.
The Chukchi people have come to Alaska.
Happening.
Yes.
Right.
You're not allowed to mistreat your dogs. I love that, Robert. And thank you for putting it that way. I like hearing
no problem.
You put it that way. Yeah.
Dorothy, anything in closing?
No, I just wanted to, you know, really thank Joanne. I think it's fascinating, and, you know, I'm getting notes from my readers. I can't wait to read, to hear the rest of the show. And, again, you know, it's a
give
wonderful trilogy.
Give them all
trilogy.
A hug to me. Thank you.
No, I wish I could. We'll give a big group virtual hug, right?
But
again,
right.
You know, it's a fantastic trilogy, Arctic Storm, Arctic Shadow, and Arctic Whale. And thank you so much for being on our show. I really appreciate it. It was great talking to you.
I appreciate your time and interest, yours and Robert's, and I just have, you know, there's a lot of fur baby love in the room, right?
Yes, absolutely.
So, thank you both very much, and just continued luck with all your sled dog racing, and Dorothy with all of your amazing social media things, and I just appreciate going right to the dog's mouth, not the horse's mouth. Well, whatever that saying is, because Robert's right where the Iditarod and everything happens, and Dorothy, you're right where, very close to where Leonard Topalo brought those animals that are the foundation for the breed. So it's just sort of magical speaking to the both of you. So thank you so much.
Wonderful.
Well, to Joanne and to Dorothy, you know, the door is always open. So if you guys ever make it up to Alaska, you can come up for a visit for sure. You know, I've been telling that to Dorothy for 3 or 4 years now, so I might just have to buy her a plane ticket one of these days and say,
that'll
you've
be my
come
first plane ride. That will be my very first plane ride.
Very good.
I think,
well, guys,
thank
you very much.
If you sent your sled dog team to get me, that would be good.
Well, you know, there was a guy.
It takes about two months to get across by sled dog if you're going.
Right.
From,
you know, there was a guy.
That's only Alaska, but to get to Robert, maybe it won't take you 2 months on by sled.
Dorothy, are you familiar with the story that the guy that rode his dog sled from, I guess it was from Alaska to Washington, D.C.? There was a train ride involved, but he rode his sled pretty much from here to about where you're at, so I guess it's possible.
Wow.
Yeah, we can see some snow.
There you go. All right, guys. Well, thank you for joining us, and we'll see you guys next time here on the Sci-Five. We'll be on next month. We typically record on Sundays, so we'll be on during the month of May. Then we'll move into our summer season, and we have some interesting news to bring up in a month or so about our July show. I think that'll be pretty interesting. We don't want to let the cat out of the bag yet, do we, Dorothy?
We don't.
Very good. Very good, guys. All right. So we'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.